Yourself right now, you can do it. and go out on the net and see those wonderful cards that he has over there in Philadelphia. And Dr. Richard Cernicola, a specialist in acute musculoskeletal pain management at 2002 Sunset Avenue, 774-0601. And he's a supporter of this show. And Upstage Magazine, Gary Green, great publication. You can call Gary at 280-3305 or go to upstagemagazine.com. You can read the whole magazine on the internet. I think he has a few archives up there, archive copies you can check out too. And he's also EzraMusic.com. Very talented fellow. Poetry, comedy, dance, as well as rock, all there in Upstage Magazine. And
good arts coverage. General New Jersey arts coverage. Very good.
And the Rags. The Rags is a monthly entertainment source serving the Jersey Shore with 12,000 readers. The Rags can be found in Seabright as well as Point Pleasant and all points in the train. That's Donnie G. The Rags covers local theater, restaurants, bartenders, and musicians. And this is going to show live tonight over the web and in a few hours in recorded form on the web. And the storage of that site and the hand-holding and consulting is brought to you by Pete Walton, EzraPark.net. It just has a shower. And looks, you know, it's drying up. And they blow away in front of your eyes. You're very nice.
Well, we'll pull you back.
Pull you back, Pat. Pete Walton, Pete, could you tell us if we're up there and live and coming through all right? But Pete is your source for Esbury Park news and information 24 hours a day at EzraPark.net. And Fox also tell me what you're going to say. The hardware store, Esbury Park's very own family-run hardware store. With the big store prices, that's Olivia and Sam. And John Kerr, of course, calls in to give us a shout-out, hearing it. And they're all willing and able and very friendly, and they will solve all your hardware issues. And they have garden supplies and all that sort of thing. And you can save the gas, don't go out to the highway. Go right down Main Street to the hardware store. And we're up on the Internet.
Oh, Lordy.
I don't have to care about
it. And you don't have to run out of the studio back
then. Yeah, really.
You're done. The computer or whatever.
Fonz, is it logo? You look like you were kind of leaning down to listen. It's just right?
You gave a thumbs up.
Okay. That's great. This is a trick thing, right? Well, maybe it's like... We're drinking water on the air. Yes, it was. Thank you.
Like a baby bottle.
It is like a baby bottle. And 428 Main Street, Esbury Park, is the place to go for the hardware store. And the firm is Bowen for Nicola, LLC in the gallery in Red Bank. Call Bowen for Nicola at 732-345-0600 for condemnation, eminent domain, and redevelopment law. That's Paul for Nicola, 732-345-0600. And the girls were the arms. You have to run out there. There's only 8 units left.
Count them. 8.
Maybe it's less. I don't know. That was 8 last week. When location, style, and value matter in your choice of a residential condominium. President pause. Galsworthy Arms is your destination. Located 1 block from the Atlantic Ocean in Long Branch's trendy West End, this property offers the best characteristics of the shore lifestyle, which means you walk to the beach on your house. Not bad. It's kind of, as I said, they're what, 2-story, you know, so they're not towering over you. They're comfortable and don't feel out of control. You can actually see the interiors and the exteriors if you go to EzraRadio.com. And you can give Joanne Ricciardi, the director of marketing, a call immediately. 908-337-2224. 908-337-2224. I just got a thought.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you like to like go in the other room and call her up, see what happened? You should call her up just to see what happened.
All right, I will.
This is really amazing. Oh, she never gets any calls. They never call from this show.
Well, I'm not going to buy an apartment over the air.
You don't have to do that.
Huh?
If you want to.
what
you have a credit card on you?
No.
For very reason. Just call her up and say, is this Joanne? Is it really a joke? Do it with this. Oh, you're no fun. Oh, she's going to do it. She's really great. Without the support of these underwriters, we wouldn't be able to buy this airtime from WYGG. And without those airwaves, Asbury Radio couldn't bring you shows like this one tonight, which is going to be a very intelligent discussion of the strongmen of Cuba, not Fidel. This was the predecessor to Fidel. Fulgencio Batista. Batista. That's still kind of, you know, people who had to flee Cuba and spit that out. Batista. I'm not going to tell you anything about him because the man who wrote the first volume of two-volume biography is with us tonight, Frank Arvodi Frere, and he's going to be telling us about that. So, let me get to... Oh, we have a new underwriter. This is Roadrunner Rides, Tours and More, and that's our friend Louie, and if you call him on his cell phone, he will come and pick you up in his bicycle. Boy, I need to find out what we're supposed to call this. It's kind of like a rickshaw, you know, but it's a bicycle. You got the picture now. Call Louie at 201-893-5528. That's 201-893-5528. And that's for Rides, Tours, and More. Louie is the only ride on the Asbury Park Boardwalk. And he'll take you all around, you know, from your hotel to a restaurant, from the beach with all the junk to your car, vice versa. Think of it. A lot of ideas. We'll talk a little bit more about Louie in an hour. We want to tell people that June 10th, that's Saturday, right? What's today? June 10th, Mike Ferentino and Christian Beach of Transfusion M are playing at FICA. And that, of course, is the Shore Institute of Contemporary Arts there at 23rd Avenue in Long Branch. What happened?
Well, I got her phone answering machine.
See? She knew she wasn't
and yeah, but she did say this is Joanne Ricciardi, so she does exist, and I gave her a shout-out on the telephone. I
oh, said. That's a good thing.
Yes, I said it was Asbury Radio calling,
and Maureen was very much interested in the $800,000 unit.
Yes.
So I think they'll be getting a call real soon.
There isn't any $800,000 unit. But, no, they're very, very reasonable.
I said you were willing to pay in that way.
I got big bucks, and I'm willing to pay.
Yeah, right.
That's
a very dull, practical joke. I don't
I just can't
we, like, do something like Steve Allen used to do and, you know, just call people at random and, you know, pretend we're tax collectors or something?
You know, how did they get away with that in the old days, you know?
Yeah.
You can't even call anybody at all, right? I mean, unless I do that on my cell phone. Mm-hmm. Are they allowed to dial out? It's kind of like a prison.
Yeah, it is.
It can only get collect calls, you know, or make collect calls. How does that work again? Paul, are you out there?
My old prisoner source.
Oh, boy.
I don't conjure up trouble with
yeah,
that.
You got a source in prison. I love it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you about that sometime. You're going to buy me a martini.
23rd Avenue. Okay, that's the FICA. And John Pfeiffer asked us if he could announce Transfusion M playing at FICA. And it says, John Pfeiffer, has taken over the Shore World column for the late, great Chris Barry. And John T. Ward has a website called redbankgreen.com. Check it out. He's got some weird stuff on there.
Is that so we've had as a guest on our show?
Once, yeah, yes. John Ward, yeah. Another of my New Brunswick friends,
that's
another former home news reporter.
Yeah, very good one.
So. Oh, yeah, yeah. And he's a freelance now, writes a lot for New Jersey Monthly, and he started this website thing to be sorry.
What's
it called again? Red Bank Green.
RedBankGreen.com.
Did you ever look up the Brooklyn, the kid from Brooklyn I told you to look up?
No, I don't.
Oh, my God. Oh, the kid from Brooklyn.com.
I promised to do and then just, you know.
So go on the kid from Brooklyn.com. Check it out. I see everybody's going to leave our show. But
you come right back.
Very funny. You got to go on there. And that, of course, was Rich Petro who put me wise to that one. The kid from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It would
be hysterical. Rich and his lovely wife, Connie, took me to dinner so we could watch Karen Lee in her Karen Lee trio mm-hmm. at Giamano's. It was absolutely marvelous. And who did I see? As soon as we sat down and ordered our Getty Martini.
Yes.
Enrique. Actually, he spotted me.
Mm-hmm.
And he came running out. I said, Maureen, how are you? Sorry, Nick. Enrique is a keyboardist who played with Yardi.
Uh-huh.
Yardina. Yardina.com. If you want to check her out.
The artist who you stood up in New York City this week.
Tuesday night.
Yeah.
But
I'm glad I'm not the only one who stands up.
I do.
To know you could, too.
Well, I had really pressing things. I couldn't go in. But, I'd love to. Listen. Go out and hang out in New York, really, you know? I'm going to do that. Anyway, people don't care about that. Just wanted to tell folks, this is from Kids. This Kids, her phone is, she's getting the cable. I have to find out how that is, too, because I'm ready, boy. I got another telephone bill, like $130, $140 for nothing.
Standing there, yeah.
How many people out there are fed up and not going to take anymore with their telephone bills? Boy, call in 775-0821. 775-0821. So you've got to use your stupid phone to do it. But anyway, Ms. Kids is getting her phone changed over the cable. And she just wanted to tell you that the loose car course of Asbury Tower, under the direction of Mr. Joe Bowen of Asbury Park, will be at Asbury Tower on Sunday and Monday, June 25th and June 25th.
Maybe June 25th?
Maybe. At 2 p.m. in the dining room. And if there is no charge, just come ahead. All invited will entertain at any nursing home or rest home, etc. How about a gin mill? Come on, kids. if you want her, you must get the chorus, of course, I'm saying it up. If you want the chorus to come out and entertain you, please call Kids at 732-775-0662. 775-0662. And she said we are doing road shows that week, too, at the Manor by the Sea and Waterford Glen.
Very nice.
Proud of her, huh? She'll be on Broadway now.
Do they play private parties?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh,
that's what she meant here. Can she come out of the cape? Maybe. Maybe that'll be next. John Caspi and his band. John Caspi, nice guy. Very, very nice fellow and talented, and that's about to bring a CD. I'm sorry, John. I'll do it next week, promise. This Saturday, June 10th, at McDonough's Pub, and that's up there on Front Street in Keyport. And while you're up there in Keyport, that's 9:30 to 1:30 a.m., you're going to do mostly originals in the first set and then mostly fun covers for the rest of the night. Free admission, always a great time. It's a fun hometown venue with great drink selection. Thanks to all who came out to the Club Deep on Sunday, he said. Hope to see you all again at Club Deep this Sunday, June 11th, when Red Roots will play from 2 to 7 p.m. Actually, that wasn't John Caspi who said that. That was that was Denise who sent me that. But go on out to Club Deep on Sunday, and that's 2 to 7 p.m. For Raz Roots. But John Caspi, there in Keyport, is also going to be, remember Susan Pellegrini?
Mm-hmm. Of course. That's
she has good. An art show there on Front Street in Keyport. It's going to be starting up. So
wonderful.
Yeah.
Good visual artist.
And I think that might be Carolyn Ross. All right.
Check it out.
The Dude Heads. Listen up, Dude Heads. Friday, tomorrow night, the Cambridge Inn, Spotswood, this is the Voodoo fans, Spotswood, New Jersey, 10 p.m. Yeah, we're back at Cambridge, Great Grub, 1,000 sports events on 24 TVs, plus there's never a cover charge. We take advantage of its proximity to home to invite some of our friends to join in the fun. And that's CambridgeInn.com in Spotswood. 251-7400, or go on the website, cambridgein.com, for the Voodoo. And is that for us, folks? Okay. Right. Is this Carolyn Moss?
Yes, it sure is.
Hey, thanks for calling in from Florida.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate it. This is Maureen. I got Maura Martello there on the
Hi.
Other mic. And it sounds busy in the background.
Yeah, I'm trying to find a quiet room. I have a 4-year-old son and 72 parrots, so it does. Often the bathroom is the place to go.
Oh boy! So well, here we are, probably in the echo chamber. You want to sing a few bars? Actually, you don't need an echo chamber. You're very talented, and I really enjoy your CD.
Oh, thank you so very much. I appreciate being appreciated.
Well, now, what's your son's name?
My son's name is Gabriel Joseph Jules Agostino Moss.
Wow. And how old has he learned how to spell it?
No, actually, you know, when he was very tiny, because he just had these two absolutely round brown eyes, I started calling him Cookie because they look like chocolate chips.
And here they are. Look at this. See, it's
adorable.
Oh,
very
adorable. And that's him on the cover of the record, and I have to somehow walk him out to a further room. Okay, he loves Thomas the Train, so maybe if I take the train and walk him that way, he'll follow. But he's very smart. I got your nose thing didn't work at all even the first time. I figured that out.
And the peekaboo, forget it, huh?
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Right? Well, I did get to see him when you were playing in Wonder Bar,
yes.
And he is very bright, very sweet kid. He was right up on the stage with you and enjoying it, you know, keeping it up.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this. The CD is called Brand New World.
Yeah.
I really love it. These are the originals that you wrote?
Some of them are, and some of them aren't. I do have a song that was done by the Dictators there, and it's called Stay With Me. And
appropriate for tonight. We're having the author of a biography about Batista on this show.
I've always loved this song, and I always had this idea to cover it, and I'm glad that I finally had the opportunity to.
And what's that one called?
Stay With Me.
Stay With Me. Okay.
Uh-huh. And there was also a Steve Forbert song on there.
Oh, yeah.
I guess he did it with Steve Berg producing in 1985, who contributed that wonderful, very Spanish-sounding guitar lick.
Yeah.
And sometime when I first got a computer getting all sorts of ideas for doing different things and typing out stuff the first time, and I just had this idea to do it in Spanish. And I remember asking my mother if she would translate it at the time. She thought it was absolutely out of my mind. I kind of let the idea, just go on the back burner.
Your mom speaks Spanish?
Yes, my mother speaks Spanish, as does my father. I just really always thought, there's actually three songs that I had in mind that I will one day translate all three. But anyway, when I was doing the record with Berg, he just said, what was that idea you had with that Spanish thing? And I thought, well, okay, here, the time has come. Time has come. So I called my mother on the phone. I sent her a cassette tape, and she faxed me the lyrics. And I sang them off the sheet with the help of a guy that was a guitar player at a restaurant called El Del Paso on Thompson Street in the Village.
Really?
A guy named Arturo Vega was his name, he was a wonderful singer, that would go table to table, and so he helped me with it.
Well, it's all the songs, I just love them, and I played it again today, and we're going to play some tonight, as soon as you hang up from you, we'll play a little lick there. And when did you put this out?
This album just came out, several months ago. I honestly, with all the moving and the stuff I've done in the past few months, I can't tell you when, although I did write everything on the webpage when it did come out. But it seems like it's been years since.
Yeah.
It was recorded in 98 to 99. Steve Berg has passed away since over a year ago.
Yeah, very
and the record was done at the end of 98, he asked me if I wanted to come to the city to do a record. I said yes. I sent all my demos via MP3, which was unheard of media at that time.
At that point, yeah.
I couldn't get to the post office. I just had a car. I was living in Nashville.
Oh.
And it was easier for me to do everything by computer. So then
amazing.
I flew up to New York, and we did that. And He never shopped it. I think he just did a minimal amount of work trying to get it sold to somebody. And at his funeral, I met so many nice people who loved the music that we had done together. And after some persuading from friends, they just thought that I should put it out. I did.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did. And it's lovely. I love this picture of yourself.
You know, it's great. Funny because those came from a ship. I took those photos on a ship. That one on the cover was my brother-in-law's photo. And it all fit in together with Brand New World, which is one of the songs. That was the original name of the record when we first made CDR copies.
Mm-hmm.
But Brand New World ended up also tying in with our Walt Whitman poem, which is kind of like an epitaph, which I in that little bit of a paragraph I have there about Berg, I kind of have that in there as
yeah.
well. So everything seemed to be very kind of all come together. The picture being taken on a ship, Brand New World, and the Whitman. So
yeah, the sunset you took on the ship. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it does. It all comes together, and just the vibes are right there. Now, you actually used to live up this way, right?
Yes, I did.
And did you go to school here? Or?
No, I'm from New York. I was born in Bronxville, New York, actually, and grew up in Long Island, but spent a lot of time in the city and went to school in the city later on to acting school when I was 16, and I lived in the village for
More as an actress, too.
Yeah, I was, until I saw the kind of world I was going into and auditioning into, and I seemed to only be able to do character parts. I wasn't really, didn't really have the looks to play the kind of roles that I wanted to, so I didn't do that for very long.
Well, how long did you last, Maura? Maura was on TV.
Oh. I professionally pursued it from at least 1974 to, I guess, the late early 90s.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, that's a long run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm still involved.
It's hard. You know, I remember my dad saying to me, my father was an opera singer for a while, and what he hated about that is that, you know, people will be talking to you, and the minute that you leave the room, it's like, oh, you know, I hate them. I hate the way they sing, all right? You know, the experiences that made him, leave that field were very similar to how I felt. And I didn't, you know, I've always been singing and playing in high school. I mean, I was doing it from the point when I was 13. I think I started playing guitar at 11. Now at 6, but, you know, I was always performing. Mm. So there were many things that I liked, and I just realized that I wanted to do what I wrote. I wanted to do me. I didn't want to do somebody else.
Yeah, you didn't want to play someone else.
Right,
yeah.
I wanted to be.
So you're making your way back up here again, too.
Yeah.
Huh? That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it actually is. It's also something that's kind of happened really fast, because I was just at the Wonder Bar a week and a day ago, and prior to that, I just thought I was coming for a visit.
Hmm.
And, you know, 3 days at the hotel over there by the Berkeley Carteret. What a creepy yet wonderful place.
Yes.
Yeah, Karloff by the sea.
Yes, the Shining. Sometimes.
But it's got these great large windows that you can sit in. And my son actually thought we were on a ship.
Yeah, well, you can see the ocean right there.
Yeah. He said when he got home, he said he loved the ship.
That's as close as I want to get, actually. One of those rooms. So you're looking at property now, and if anybody wants to tell you about a property, should they send you an email?
Yeah, at samlorac@AOL.com. That's samlorac@AOL.com.
LORAC?
Yeah, it's actually Carol Moss backwards. I was born Carol. Ed is Carol, and later on when people would think that Carol Moss was one word.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, this is Carol Moss Paul.
Oh.
What's your first name?
Too short a name, huh?
Yeah.
AOL?
Uh-huh, AOL.com.
Okay. And how can they buy your CD?
Actually, you know, I used to have a fan club that was doing a really good job of selling them to Amazon, where you actually have to still mail them out. A CD Baby will sell them where they mail them out, and I've mailed out a bunch of them to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I was trying to do it at my website, but with all the moving and stuff, I was just really getting behind on mailing things to people. So the only available way now is whatever is out there at Tower. I mean, there are all kinds of compilations that I have nothing to do with.
Oh.
Yeah, there are records that are out there when I went to Italy recently, I saw that there's all these compilations that have been, you know, sprung from records that I did in Germany, and they're on labels like French labels and stuff. So there's all sorts of things that it's selling at Tower Records. There's a live record on MTV that's a double CD, which, you know, none of these things, of course, I get any money from.
Boy. Well, how about this CD?
This CD is available from CD Baby, and I think that they've somehow linked themselves to Tower, so Tower gets it from them, and then they get it from me ultimately.
Oh, okay. But we'll have to figure out a way that you can get all the money for it and not have to share it.
The Tower thing is, you know, I'm happy with anything from it, you know, from Tower CD Baby. It's easy because it's hard for me to get to the post office all the time.
Yeah.
I take care of my aunt's and Alzheimer's patients, and I don't always get an opportunity to leave.
Well, what's going to happen when you move up here?
Well, I'm not going to move up there. What I'm going to do is be there sometime.
Oh, I see. I got it.
I can come down with my son and, you know, at least have him be able to experience snow, one, because I think that's horrible to deprive of that. And be able to have a place to go to maybe write, you know, and be around other musicians and maybe try to get a band together.
We'll
but
be glad
still come
to
back
see
to
you.
Florida, you know, because I have my mom and my family.
Yeah, I have to do that. Well, we'll be glad to see you when you get up here, and I'd like you to introduce one of the songs from your CD.
Okay.
So we can tell people, let people listen to what we've been talking about.
Okay. You want me to pick one, in other words?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. okay, yes, okay. I would probably say that Crazy for Your Love is probably my favorite song.
All right.
On that CD, and
okay, that's number five. We'll be coming front. And how do you pronounce that? S.Q. Shame? Is that how you say it?
Which?
S.Q. Shame, the one you were telling us about?
Oh, Escúchame.
Oh.
Oh, Escúchame, which literally means listen to me. And the song was listen to me. And my mother has written the lyrics.
And we have to let the... Okay, we're going to let the listeners listen to you right now. Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Come see us again soon.
I'll see you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Isn't that lovely? And her little son. We should ask just for
it's adorable.
First name.
Yeah. So run up to Tower and get it in the photo.
Yeah. Yeah. Go to Tower Records and pick that up or CD Baby. And you want Carolyn Moss's Brand New World.
All right.
Now we have Dan Chantemayo on the line.
Oh. Hello, Dan.
Come in Detroit. Was that a nice song?
That was great, yeah. Yeah.
She's very, very talented, this woman. Carolyn Moss. So, now, I actually printed out a copy of what you had on the internet. Do you want me to read it for you?
Sure.
So people know what we're talking about. Now, this is what you posted up there on the Yahoo, and I tried to do it and didn't do it right. I didn't use the link right. Sorry about that. The city of Asbury Park transferred the Triangle property to Asbury Partners in 2002 with the price to be determined at a later date, still not resolved. Significant portions of the adjoining streets will be vacated and given to Asbury Partners at no additional cost, which will substantially enlarge the site and what can be built there. The city demanded $490,000 in 2004, and Asbury Partners offered $175,000. The question that you're proposing on this poll was, should a lawsuit be brought to turn back the conveyance and compel the city to offer the Triangle and the street vacation areas to the highest bidder in an open public RFP, or request for proposal?
Now you know how I feel about this.
I'm coughing down here. Thank you, Frank. You could also send them out for coffee. So, the question is, what kind of a response did you get?
Well, I didn't look this afternoon. I had looked this morning, and I think there were like 16 or 17 votes, all in favor with the exception of one.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I mean, on these polls, I think the highest number of votes we've ever gotten has been like 25 in a particular poll. Now, the poll closes tomorrow. I actually can go in and extend it if your listeners, other people want to vote.
Right.
But, the question I posed, and it was...
And let me give the other number, too, so 775-732-775-6203, because you're on 0821, right?
Right.
Okay. 6203, if you wanted to call in and comment on it. And go ahead, Dan.
Well, I mean, this has been an ongoing issue for me. What brought it up again was a recent article that Cory Booker, the mayor-elect of Newark, had brought a lawsuit to turn back a sale of city land to a private developer that was done without a public bidding process. And this is something, you know, similar situations I've been involved in professionally. For instance, most recently with Jet Stadium, I was in the camp of Madison Square Garden fighting, you know, one of the issues they were fighting was that the city was dealing just with one potential purchaser, the Jets. And, you know, the truth is you really can't get a fair price or the price that you should get in the open market if you don't actually put the property out to bid in the open market. I mean, you just wouldn't do that with your house if you're trying to sell your house to negotiate with one person, you're trying to give it to real estate,
right.
And put it on a multiple listing.
Sure. You have to sell it to one person, you know you're not going to get a fair price. Because you're saying you don't have an open market.
And now, I don't know if people understand. So the way that the price to be determined is through an appraisal process where the city gets an appraisal, the developer gets an appraisal. If they can't agree, they pick a third appraiser who then makes the decision. And the value is... fixed as of August 2001. And, you know, that's like at the point of time, or actually, maybe it's April 2001, but in 2001 sometime. And it's right at the point when Asbury Partners came in and with the development rights and the litigation was sort of lifted from the development rights on the waterfront. And I don't know what Asbury Partners has done for them to get the benefit of that, because clearly it would be a lower value you know, in consideration of litigation hanging over 2001 period. I mean,
right,
right, and the city actually conveyed title in October 2002 to this property, but the price hasn't been set and the price has not been paid. I mean, if you remember in December 2004, I think it was, the city took like $400,000 on account. You know, so later determined if it was less than $400,000, they'd have to give back some money. And they took $400,000 because that was the amount of shortfall in the budget. And that's how that price came up. But, you know, here it is, 2006.
Right, the city already took that amount of money, yeah.
Right, I mean, it's 2006 now. It's an extremely valuable parcel. We haven't gotten the money for it. There is no provision in there. I mean, this could go on to 2010, 2012. There's no provision in the agreement for interest loan. And even interest wouldn't give you, you know, the increases in market value. I mean, the parcel is not under condemnation. There's no project enhancement rule or project rule like they're claiming with property owners. So there's absolutely no rationale for this property to be valued as of August 2001 and to be only negotiated with Asbury Partners.
Mm-hmm.
They could absolutely today get several millions of dollars for that parcel. And you know,
what about the redevelopment rights, though? Would the city have to do the same thing and pay Asbury Partners for the redevelopment rights?
I don't know, because that is something to be negotiated. Perhaps not, because if you recall, it would depend upon the legality of it, but if you recall, the reason why they sold the Triangle parcel to Asbury Partners is that the parcel actually fell outside the lines of the development rights. Now, whether they legally redrew the lines to include it and then get additional consideration is another issue. But you know something? I don't know. It's debatable whether somebody would have to be approved as a sub-developer by Asbury Partners. Perhaps they might have to pay infrastructure, but I don't know if they would have to pay the green mail that Asbury Partners demands, you know, 5 or 7% of gross sale proceeds. And, I mean, it's not subject to condemnation. You know, it'd be sort of like the issue with the Salvation Army building. You know, it was left out. There are private owners now who are developing that parcel. I'm unsure of whether they actually have to pay infrastructure costs, but I think there's a lawsuit that they don't have to pay Asbury Partners for their own parcel.
There's a lawsuit that who doesn't have to pay?
Well, I think what private people bought the Salvation Army building and want to redevelop.
Oh, right. There was a decision on that, right?
Yeah. And, you know, Asbury Partners was claiming, well, you can't let them, you know, develop that parcel because, you know, I mean, in plain terms, we have a monopoly on the waterfront.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lawsuit about that. I forget if it got resolved.
Well, I heard that Henry Vaccaro won the lawsuit. If Henry wants to call in, that would be great and clarify this point. But I thought that the point that Asbury Partners was making was that it was left out because it was a non-profit, the Salvation Army, that owned the building. And once it was changed hands into a private entity, profit-making corporation, then that automatically put it back into play.
Well, you know something? It doesn't say that in any of the documents. So, tough luck, you know?
Hey, was that something Alfred missed?
Yeah, you know, I guess he was busy with his divorce at that point.
What's this?
Oh, right, I know.
Alfred Fiala had to put all his worldly possessions in his ex-wife's name. So sad. I understand he was out last night. He was at the council meeting.
No, I missed it.
I had one of those with Bluetooth, you know.
Oh, your phone?
Yeah. Of course, that must have been his whole income for the year, I think.
Well, it's probably paid like an expense account or something, so it's been a long time.
He probably expensed it out, yeah.
But, you know, I think people should care about this. And, you know, I'm taking the temperature again because, you know, if I got an overwhelming response, the next question would be, are you willing to contribute to a lawsuit to do so.
Yeah.
Of course, it could be several millions of dollars to the city. And why
are
we giving...
Oh, they said back in 2002, wasn't it? 2001. 2002, when we signed the agreement, people in the business said in public session that it was worth $10 million. That's awesome.
Well, if you could develop it, it is. You know, several months back when I brought this issue up again, and Jimmy Bruno got irate at me and said, you can't tell me in 2001 that parcel wasn't worth anything. You know, when I first brought it up in 2004, you know, they all agreed that it was probably worth a lot more money. You know, and Lofredo was outspoken about it until the next week he had a change of heart.
And you mean outspoken in favor of getting more money for it?
Yeah, that they thought both the city's appraisal and the developer's appraisal was too low. You know, Lofredo said, in his professional opinion, that parcel was worth a lot more money. You know, and all the issues I brought out before, even the process that they're going through now, purportedly to follow the process outlined in the sales...
We're plugging in a second part. Go ahead.
They didn't follow. In other words, one of the city was supposed to get their appraisal first and develop it at like the price they got theirs. It happened the other way around. The developer, or vice versa. I actually was, the developer was supposed to get theirs first, city didn't like it, they got theirs. But, you know, it didn't happen that way. The city got the appraisal first, and then the developer did. And then secondly, the qualifications set forth for the people that do the appraisal, the developer's appraisal does not meet them.
Take back the triangle.
I was thinking, why do we have to go to the extent of a lawsuit to do this? Is there another way to do this?
If I could speak up for a
second. It's the pizza talking. I recognize this voice.
Yes, one of my favorite topics. If they transferred title to this to the triangle, to Asbury Partners, isn't there a basic tenet that they have to pay something, even if it's $1 or $10 or something?
Well, they did pay $1 when the title was transferred.
I'm surprised they're not saying that's enough for it, given the I'd like to say, as far as value is concerned, I understand they were thinking that they could get 90 units.
At least, right?
93
years.
93. Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, being involved in development for about 30 years, a typical developer, when valuing what to pay for land, would consider 25% of his net, of his sale price would be attributable to the land.
It depends upon the market, but, you know...
A waterfront parcel? On, you know, pretty much an oceanfront parcel?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, in expensive markets like Manhattan, you know, the price of land is up, so sometimes it's more than 25%.
But you say, let's use that as a...
minimum.
A base rate, 25%. Say we built a very value-priced development, 90 units, and we sold them for the cheapest price that Paramount is selling the North Beach for, $400,000. That means that triangle is worth to a developer $9 million. Mm-hmm. We're selling it for $400,000. Where is the reality here?
Well, I'll give you a better one. I mean, look at the upfront purchase price that Metro Homes paid Asbury Partners. It came out to something like $77,000 a unit. Now, that doesn't include, you know, the percentage of gross proceeds or the infrastructure costs. And I claim those are additional acquisition costs.
Correct.
If you add those all in, I think the infrastructure was set at $20,000 per unit, so that bumps up to $97,000 a unit. And then in the Metro Homes pro forma for financing the development, they estimated the 7% share of gross proceeds to Asbury Partners at $11 million. I broke that down. You know, it all comes out to like $32, $33 million and like over $122,000 per unit. So, I mean, if you do $122,000 per unit for 93 units, yeah, all right, maybe they're not as valuable. Say they're $100,000 a unit you pay for the value. You know, you're talking about over $9 million.
I rest my case. That's what it should be sold for.
$9 million.
And
I just want to throw in here that John Lafredo told me they would never sell that piece of property, that that was not going to be developed.
Well, he might have been talking about the marine.
No,
marine,
no, he was talking about the triangle.
Well, we know John Lafredo's track record on you know, living up to what he said. As far as the lawsuit, Dan, when it's ready, you can count me in.
All right, that's good.
You can count me in. matter of fact, I know a couple of developers that would probably pay $9 million for it.
I'm sure if you put it to open bidding process, because I don't know if people realize,
I keep
talking about the street vacation areas, but that is the only development parcel that will be true waterfront. Of course, the very sketchy diagrams, like what they would allow there, shows like townhomes actually touching the beach parcel, because part of Ocean Avenue would be vacated, but the easterly portion, and it would sort of be like an access road. So there'd be like different heights of buildings, but there would be separate, actually, like townhomes they have in the diagram that would actually be the only ones in Asbury Park that are on the beach.
Right, right. So that's very valuable property, obviously. And you know, we really do need the money. If you look at the agenda for last night, capital ordinance for the fire department, $300,000 was introduced. A bond ordinance for $2.2 million. This is all borrowing, right? Another bond ordinance for $650,000. And now I understand that the sewer monies, they're saying that the money that the Asbury Partners were supposed to pay for the sewer was only for the exterior, not for the interior. And, of course, they have a stink problem here in Asbury Park.
It says Paella's fingerprints all over it.
Well,
I wonder if he was the architect of the, you know, selling the triangle for a 2001 price.
Oh, I'm sure he was the architect of all those things.
Yeah. Well, I think Gerard, there is a paper trail that leads to that.
But Aaron always backed him up on that. Jimmy Aaron, who's our redevelopment attorney.
So he backed him up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, he always said, no, the reason that you have to pay, you know, you can only get that much is because, and it's a developer-driven plan.
But, you know, it's different. Even though I disagree with this whole project rule that they're just taking people's properties for 2001 prices, you know, because, you know, I always say, what project are you talking about? I mean, Asbury Partners, exactly what have they done? But here was a parcel that the city owned, had nothing to do, was not in the development rights. And there was, Asbury Partners has done nothing to get the benefit of distressed and depressed prices. They didn't put out any money for it, you know, so they don't have to.
Finish that thought. They didn't put any money out for...
Well, I'm saying, you know, the rationale is, well, you know, Asbury Park has got the CAFRA, they got this, and they bought the development rights. Okay, but what's for that? They've got 56 acres. We've got this little triangle. You know, I mean, they didn't do this all for the triangle.
56 acres is waterfront property. Priceless.
I mean, if you remember, I showed you that interview with Hugh Lamley from MD Schatz, which is the bank behind Asbury Partners, and he was, this was in 2001, he was crowing about the deal, and he said his only...
Well, that was Marty Schatz.
Marty Schatz, not Hugh Lamley, right? And he said that his own real estate people couldn't believe that they got it so cheap. But now, why do we want to compound the problem? Why did we have to give them the triangle for nothing?
Yeah. And because they add up all these things and they say that, you know, they're going to do the casino and take care of the convention hall, but then again, they brought them for next to nothing.
Well, you know, Maureen, I want to bring up the thing that they brought up where they had $33 million to do the casino.
Yeah.
Where is that now?
Yeah. Well, there's only, you know, I'm coming up on 3 minutes now for 9 o'clock.
Well, I brought that up.
Yeah.
Because on the dispute resolution, they said, you know, they got to put up 25% of the amount to do the casino. And that's still the problem with the dispute resolution, is that the 25% is only the upfront cost. And I think it was like $6 million for all of the other stuff. And the remainder, which we heard that it's supposed to be just $33 million for the casino, there's nothing hard in that dispute resolution that, you know, it says by a certain time, you know, the city will look into it and with them work it out, the schedule and the cost and stuff like that. But there's nothing holding their feet to the fire to actually do it.
No, and the only money that's been put forward is being held by escrow partners' attorneys.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can, your whole thing is by escrow.
Yeah, but it's the attorney holding it. His attorney. How about our attorney hold it?
Well, it doesn't matter. Attorney would be, you know, subject to the same restraints and releasing and escrow.
It should have been put with an independent escrow agent.
Correct.
That's what it should have been done. And I just want to say one quick thing. The same dog and pony show they did here in Asbury was saying they had $33 million. They were holding up that same $33 million to the city of Patterson saying, look at all the money we have to spend. And I have to say, Patterson said, get out of here.
Yeah.
That's very good part. I'll free up your phone line.
Yeah, I will tell. But, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the face thing. And, you know, it's 4 years later, and nothing has been done.
All right. Well, let's see how many more people would go to. How do they get this poll? How do they get? Do you have to be a member of Yahoo?
I don't know. No. I think you'd have to join the group, which
is automatic.
But I don't know the address. But if you search Yahoo groups and search for Asbury Park, one word, it will bring up that group. And it'll be on the left hand side. There's a link for polls.
Maybe we could also. I think you have your own Yahoo group, don't you? It may not be as active as the Asbury Park, but you're still there.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Because there are a few Asbury Park Yahoo groups.
Yeah, but this is the only one that's not separated. Asbury No Space Park.
No, I know, but I was wondering if it could be posted on several Yahoo sites.
Well, I think you have the link. I checked, the link does work on your site.
It did work?
Yes, brings you right to the poll.
Because I think I took it down again. I did, I took it off. I thought that it wasn't working right. It is 9 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay. send me the link again, okay?
Okay.
Thanks very much. Dan Salameo. Very well educated surveyor, appraiser, with his own business in New York. And you know, he's not a political guy. He's trying to get the most for our property here, not having too much stuff. We need it. Maybe we could play a little Chameleon in the background. Can we play number one of Chameleon? Holy Bryce in the background while we do the commercials. I mean, did I say commercials?
Did I say jelly?
Underwriters. All right, we want to tell people about Roadrunner Rides, tours, and more. I'm actually only getting one per show, but I'm going to give another plug here. Any place, anytime, anybody, call Louis Schneider. And that's 201-893-5528. 201-893-5528 or go to roadrunnerrides.com. You can also find Louie on our site. Dollarsworthy Arms is a 66-unit residential community with only 8 left. Traditional colonial styling, spacious 1 and 2 bedroom apartments plus ample parking and a private pool. In addition, all condominiums have large private storage rooms as well as modern laundry facilities in each building. And did I say they have a private pool? And you can look at them at asburyradio.com. Okay, isn't this nice and bad then? Call Joanne Ricciardi for Golf for the Arms at 908-337-2224. 908-337-2224. And we urge you to do something for your children and your children's children. Please keep the Metro Lyric Opera of New Jersey going by sending a donation today to some friends for only $25. And send that to Metro Lyric Opera of New Jersey, Post Office Box 35, Allenhurst, New Jersey, 07711. Madame Ira Cagnoli, the General Artistic Director, will pitch you. And the hardware store, Edgar Park's Problem Solvers, the National Hardware Store, their home fix-it consultant, is it today, 428 Main Street, or give them a phone call, 732-988-3339. That's 988-3339 for the hardware store. And the phone is going for Nicola in Red Bank, specialist in condemnation, eminent domain, and redevelopment law. Call Bo and for Nicola at 732-345-0600. That's Bo for Nicola. And now, I've been reading this book. It's really fascinating. And there's so many things I didn't know about this man. And we're going to be going now to an old friend of mine. He was always kind of, you know, peering through the stacks at the library there. I guess that was Livingston. We're going to bring up your mic. I'm going to introduce Frank, our Goaty Slayer. And Frank has written Fulgencio.
Fulgencio.
Fulgencio. Oh, you say that with an H? Fulgencio Batista. Batista? From Revolutionary to Strong Men. And this was actually published by our old alma mater, Rutgers University Press. And congratulations. He's a weighty tune. You've got 274 pages of story, and then notes, over 100 pages of notes. Yes?
Thank you, Maureen, more for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Very welcome.
Welcome. Pleasure. I happen to love footnotes, because I think some of the most interesting information is buried in the footnotes.
My
advice, I don't have footnotes personally.
Yeah,
if you're a historian, you live off the documents. That's what you base your work on, and so it's very important to, in terms of substantiating your work, to tell people. I mean, so you have to let the people, anyone who's a historian or someone who really discusses the matter, let them know where you got that information.
Yeah, we're very good about that. You can see the journalist here, you know, we're very exact.
Did a lot of research and learned to do research as a journalist.
Yeah.
And so that really helped.
Mm-hmm.
And the writing, too, even though I'm a historian and I try to make my work accessible, that's one thing another thing I learned from journalism.
It's a hard line to tread because you want to be exact, and yet sometimes the most entertaining thing is not the thing that is most, you know, expressed in such a factual way.
But I think scholars often alienate themselves by not writing. Even the most complex of concepts can be explained in a way that anyone can understand.
More accessible.
And I think what academics often do is they isolate themselves from the broader community, and they write to very narrow audiences. And so, you know, when you reflect on my journalism background, it was something that really helped me in the book, because I try to take historical concepts and bring them, into a language that's accessible and fun.
Yeah,
so it's not just to be read by academics.
Yeah,
and for Cuban experts.
Absolutely. And it drives me crazy, you know, sometimes. I teach at Kane University.
I wanted to say that you're an assistant professor of history at Kane.
Right? And it drives me crazy when my students say, oh, this is so boring. And the thing is that it's not boring. It just has to be taken off that dusty bookshelf and infused with
brought
life.
Brought back to life. I like the way you did that, because you had Batista with his concerns about his brother, the he didn't just talk about the pneumonia at the time, but the fact that they, that Batista was in a position where he had to let his brother come and live with he and his wife, his pregnant wife, mm-hmm. even though he had the pneumonia.
Tuberculosis.
I'm sorry, tuberculosis. He had pneumonia.
Yeah, it was a terrible killer. Do you want to set the framework for the time frame for the book?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say, though, that when you're talking about time frame, is that the way you brought in what was going on at these periods so that you got the whole feeling, you kind of immersed the reader in that era. But, yeah, let's talk about that, because I've already gotten some questions about the period after it follows where you, I guess it's going to be volume two.
That's right.
So volume one.
Well, volume one goes from 1901 to 1940. And the thing is that the goal of the book is to try to deal with a neglected period, Cuban history. So while I'm looking at the piece, I'm using him as a prism to get into an entire era. So the book deals with just the first part of his career, and like I said, it's made to shine a mirror on the full period of Cuba prior to the Cuban Revolution of 1959.
So this is what, that was my first question, why didn't you just go for Castro? Because, you know, that's big stuff right now, and as you said, we're coming up on the anniversary. And
well, as a historian, you seek to find gaps in our historical knowledge. So rather than Castro, there's probably 10 biographies of him. And a piece has been ignored for reasons we can get into later, if you like, but there's been a power struggle over how to define that earlier period of Cuban history, that period from 1902 to 1959. All the attention has gone to the revolution or to the independence war.
And you mentioned in your book that you know, the piece is either demonized or lionized.
There's
no in between.
Right. So he became a topic that's fruitful for historical work. For Castro is well known, and yet Batista's career is not quite as lengthy, but it's pretty long. He dominates Cuba from 1933 to 1959.
That's quite a span.
Yeah.
And everybody feels they know him, right? Everybody feels, Batista, spit it out, right? They really know.
But it was much more complicated than that.
Yes, well, he's been turned into a stick figure caricature because, and I guess we'll get into, you know, the importance of him to the Cuban Revolution itself. See, taking this whole period, with the revolution, there are two interpretations of the Cuban Revolution and of the period prior to the Cuban Revolution. One is the one that's espoused by the Cuban Revolution, which is really the one that's most popular, and that is that everything prior to 1959 was corrupt and decadent and worthless and salvaged by the revolution.
Yeah.
And that's an interpretation that's very convenient for Castro and the Cuban Revolution. It's a real, because it puts Castro in line as the savior and the spiritual heir to some of the independence leaders, particularly José Martí, who was the father of Cuba, essentially. And so that's the interpretation of Cuba prior to the revolution that we're most familiar with. And from The Godfather, too, there's a couple of great scenes. I'm doing a little book tour in Florida this summer and a little bit in the Northeast. And Borders in Eatontown on June 13th.
Yeah, keep that in mind. 7 o'clock.
Which Borders?
Eatontown Borders. Right. 7 o'clock. The
13th. That's the interpretation we're most familiar with. And there are two snippets in The Godfather 2 that I use as excerpt. One is Batista, where he's essentially meeting with Michael Corleone, a.k.a. Al Pacino, and the rest of the gangsters who are purportedly running Cuba, and there's a great scene there where he introduces them all, and then he pulls out a phone made of gold and passes it around. And then the second scene from the film that plays very much on North American stereotypes of Cuba is the scene where, remember that famous scene where Al Pacino, again, Michael Corleone, kisses Fredo? Mm-hmm. It was you, Fredo. I know it was you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then Batista gives a little speech, and then there's a little speech Batista gives saying, my position now has become untenable, and I am now forced to leave Cuba to avoid further bloodshed. So he's remembered, Batista is, as a failed dictator fleeing in the middle of the night. And so his career becomes essentially encapsulated in that one moment, whereas he is an important force in Cuban politics for almost 30 years. I'm sorry, you were going to say
that. No, actually, it's probably more interesting what the caller has to say.
Do you want me to say about the second interpretation before we take the poll?
Sure.
Yeah.
So there's the revolutionary interpretation of Cuban history, Brian. And then there's the dueling interpretation that goes contrary to that, which is the Cuban exile interpretation. And that is one that either glamorizes Cuba, not glamorizes, paints Cuba as a great paradise, and either it goes to that extreme, or it's more interpretation of Cuba as a budding democracy struggling on the way to
what period? It's the same
period. But
when Batista came in.
Yeah, what I'm saying is there are two dueling interpretations. Mm-hmm. One is the revolutionary interpretation, which demonizes Batista,
right,
as Morris says. Then there's the interpretation from the exile, which I'm not going to say lionizes him, because a lot of people, were his enemies.
Mm.
But they speak of a Cuba that was a democracy, a budding democracy, on the road to democracy.
A paradox.
In some interpretation, and on the way to becoming a full-fledged democracy and partner in with the United States and the Western Hemisphere in terms of economic prosperity. So you have those two dueling interpretations, and they don't talk to each other in any way. And so the book, my book, and other writers now, other historians who are working in this period, it's our responsibility to bridge that gap, and because that interpretation has been frozen in time, and so we need to unfreeze.
And it was a much richer tapestry the way you described it, all the many disparate things that were going on at that time. And we should go to our caller now. Good evening, and welcome to SRA Radio. You're on the air.
Hi, Marie. It's John Kirk calling.
Hey, John.
I wanted to ask the guests, well, most of my colleague guests are all kind of members of the Crane House in some way, shape, or form and stuff. I had a curious question to my mind is whether Stephen Crane had ever had any correspondence with Jose Marti, who's a poet, writer, and things like that. Very influential and all that.
And he did spend time in Cuba.
Yeah, he did spend time as a war correspondent, you know, during the Spanish-American War. And I just
Frank and I were talking about that today. Frank Delphine, gentlemen.
Yeah, I was just, whether there's any records, or whether there's letters, I was kind of curious, but he was very influential, and I just kind of, a lot of writers kind of correspond with each other during their lifetime and all that.
Mm-hmm. Frank would like to answer that.
Well, thank you for the call, John. And by the way, your name, are you the historian John Kirk or the scholar John Kirk? There's a famous Cuban scholar.
Oh, really? Not really.
Oh, it's K-E-R-R.
K-E-R-R. I am related to a very famous physicist around the turn of the century, going way back. He invented the Kerr effect, which had to do with the bending of light waves using electromagnetic energy. That goes way back. That was the question I had on him, because I didn't, whether he had, Stephen Crane had ever corresponded with him in any way, shape, or form. I know it's,
Frank has an opinion on that.
Well, let me just briefly tell you that Marti actually lived most of his life in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
He actually, as most, and Castro, ironically, ends up doing a similar fundraising effort for the Cuban Revolution of 59, mm-hmm. as Martí does at the end of the 19th century for the Cuban independence movement. So I have no doubt that Martí, now I don't know of a personal correspondence between them, but Martí was one of the most well-known journalists and poets and writers in Latin America at the turn of the century. And so no doubt he wrote about Stephen Crane and his writing.
Because
he's popularly known as really one of the main writers who interprets the United States and what's going on in the United States to Latin America. Because his writings go throughout Latin America. He writes papers in Argentina, Mexico, and he writes about the Statue of Liberty and its construction, the corruption in the Grant administration, the Ulysses S. Grant, and so forth. So,
my favorite corrupt president.
And by the way, just on Martini, if I may interject one more thing.
Sure.
He's a God figure in Cuba, very much also in need of a biography. Nothing about him has ever said that at all gives nuance or complexity to his life. Whenever you go to any celebration of Martí, it's always, you know, this deity, portrayed as a deity. And so that's historical work that needs to be done.
I believe he died, he was a fellow of Dos Rios, 1895.
He died very early.
He
was advised not to go to Cuba because he was a poet, a writer, a man that was very slim and wasn't much taller, I would say, than 5'4", 5'5".
Good, wow.
And not at all a fighter. I mean, not a soldier, per se. And he was advised not to go. He felt that it would be dishonorable not to go and fight.
Yeah.
And then he died within a few days of landing in Cuba. He was caught in an ambush.
And
you can come out and meet Frank in person at Borders on Tuesday, John.
But the person with almost your name, John Kirk, K-I-R-K,
Kirk,
has written about Martí. So if you look him up,
I'll look
him,
on
Amazon.com,
you
will find some work by him on Martí.
Oh, very good. Thank you very much, and look forward to that and all that.
We have an event coming up. Do you want to give it the dates? Do you have them in front of you?
Let's see if I got it with me on. No, hold up. I
think it's a week from Saturday.
Yeah, let's see what
you
got here.
Very exciting show. We're going to have a couple of
Pretty quickly, and
Spencer Wells, His Journey of Man. You ever seen that? He's a geneticist, and after they decoded
June 17th, screening Dr. Spencer Wells' controversial PBS documentary, Journey of the Man, 2003, 120 minutes, and then engage in a dialogue about the arbitrary practice of categorizing and separating people by race. And that's Saturday, June 17th, at 5 o'clock.
5 p.m. What is that, a Saturday?
That's Saturday, yeah.
Okay.
And then there's the duality of Betty Davis, that is Betty
Double feature.
Double feature. Betty both was two of them. It looks like there's two, Sunday, June 25th.
Okay, so the week after that.
Yeah, the letter, The letter, 1940. That was circa 1940, 95 minutes. And then there's a little intermission there, and then at 6:30 p.m. now Voyager, also 1942, 117 minutes. Frankly, does a good job on selecting these things. It's very moving movies, and you get the emotions and the full intellectual scope on everything else too.
Absolutely, and that's what 508. Is it 508?
508 Fourth Avenue.
Fourth Avenue.
Yeah.
To the Crane House, and that's where Stephen Crane actually lived.
Well, I'll bid you all good night. Thank you very much.
Well, good night, John.
I look forward to, doing for the study and everything else. So it was a pleasure calling in.
Yeah, volume two.
Volume two. Yeah. All right.
Thanks
good.
Very much,
John. Good. Have a nice evening.
You too. Bye-bye. The number to call is 775-0821.
You know, Batista was involved in you look at Batista's photo on the cover of the book, you'll see he's a
handsome fellow.
Person of a person mixed race. And
I was intrigued. The minute, I'm sorry, I'm
no, that's fine.
The minute I looked at the cover, I'm embarrassed to admit I know very little about Batista. I thought he doesn't look Cuban, whatever that means. And it's interesting tying in with what Frank is running a documentary about, you know, mythology, I guess, of race. And the first thing I thought when I looked, what was his accent?
Well, that's the, since he brought in race, our caller, I thought it might be interesting to interject the fact that a lot of dictators in the Caribbean, if they have mixed race ancestry, try to conceal that.
Yeah.
Particularly in this case. In the middle of the 20th century, early 20th century. And so, Batista, to follow up on what you were saying about his origin, a lot of his enemies said that he wasn't born in Cuba. Now, there's absolutely no basis, in fact, for that. You have accounts from childhood friends, and I went back to his hometown, and it's very dubious, that claim that he wasn't born there. But because of his features, some people argue he might have been Mexican or had some Mexican, Amerindian, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always vague about that because in Cuban history, you know, Cuba was a slave society. And after Brazil imported more slaves than any other country in the Western Hemisphere, and slavery doesn't end in Cuba until 1886. So it has a long legacy of slavery, and a politician like Batista would certainly not want to be linked to that racial tension. It could only be used against him. His racial identity as Afro-Cuban would be used against him. So his oldest son told me that his enemies always referred to him as El Negro, the black man.
Yeah.
That's the translation. And depending on how you say it, could be inferred even, another
right.
word. And his friends always called him El Indio, the Amerindian or the Indian, using race there. And he always, when asked the question, would always say, I'm Cuba.
Yes, right.
Because in a slave society like Cuba, you cannot bring the country together if you emphasize racial differences. So there's a strong racial ideology in Cuba called Cubanidad, Cubanness, which essentially tries to de-emphasize race and says, listen, whether your family's from Africa or Europe or wherever, we're one, we're Cuban. And by focusing on racial differences, it divides our nation.
And it's still going on today.
Good message.
Is it still going on today? Because you still have people who will say that the exiles, the Cuban exiles, are primarily white.
And they are.
And the people left behind in Cuba who were fought in the revolution, people that were ill, whatever you say, were often African, of African origin, perhaps. Or what do you think? Is that true?
Well, that's absolutely right. Yes. If you look at studies of the Cuban migration, there's been... when we study Cuban immigration in the United States, it's been four or five different ways. And the earlier groups, the ones who fled immediately after the Cuban Revolution, certainly were mostly white, somehow tied into at least the government in some way, and mostly Cubans of European ancestry. Later, it's Mariel Boatlift in 1880, you get a more diverse Cuban immigration, more Afro-Cubans, more poor, and so forth. So it's quite true that those divisions are still present.
Still
being felt. And Castro is skillfully, well, let me tell you a couple of little ironies about the whole thing. Batista is I think it's pretty clear, has some Afro-Cuban roots. And Afro-Cubans actually supported him because he actually worked very hard to integrate the Cuban armed forces in the revolution of 1933. So And he's actually born in a hovel, basically a small home with dirt floors, a one-room house. And so it's kind of ironic, if you think about it, that he becomes the disgraced dictator, fleeing in the middle of the night, tied in with
the power, and
Castro, who is a white European ancestor, and a child of some privilege, actually becomes this revolutionary dynamic figure who is now a champion of Afro-Cubans. But it wasn't always that way. Many
There's a lot of irony, who would have thought that this dictator, this, you know, everyone feared the name Batista, started out as a stenographer. I mean, that's hilarious.
And he used stenography. You know, one of the things I did my research was I decided to look up the old stenography books. And let me tell you something. You have to be nothing short of a genius to figure out all of the different notations.
I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I was actually had to take Latin. I
and I would rather take Latin than stenography.
You know, my mother couldn't believe it.
And you know what he used to do with the stenography? Even years later, after he learned it, and in his older years when he would give and speak, though we'd have a meeting with people, and he didn't want them to know what he was writing or thinking. He would write down his thoughts at the meeting with these stenographic notes that only he could read. And so you wouldn't know. And even if you did peer over his shoulder, or if you could read upside down,
you
wouldn't know what he was writing. So that is a little defense mechanism that he used.
And he never wrote his memoirs from all his notes, huh?
Well, that's an interesting point. The Batista family recently, literally a few months before my book went to press, donated some documents to the University of Miami. And in there, I was looking briefly through the catalog, there is something about him having written an autobiography. We know he was writing one at the time of his death. The question is, how far along was it? The family had always been reticent to provide a copy of it. And the thing about Batista, too, I have some documents of his when he was a younger man that people was able to get out of archives in Cuba. And the thing is that he is such a meticulous person that he takes a sentence and writes it, rewrites it, and writes it again. And so it's a mess to read his handwriting.
Yeah.
And so you really, it's hard to even figure out what it is that he wanted to say. So that'll be something for volume two I'll be taking a look at, is to go down there, see how much of an autobiography there is on file there. But
how much do you have of the volume two?
Well, I've done much of the research. But as a historian, you know, you never really know how far along you are until you actually put your fingers to the keyboard.
Start to put it together.
Right, and that's when all the weaknesses...
The holes.
Exactly. That's when all of whatever you miss becomes apparent. And then, you know, I'll have to come back there and the arena and say, well, will you miss that point?
Hey, sure. The incisive, intrepid reporter here.
Well, I have to be thinking about that as I go over it. So I've done a lot of the research, and I'm excited to start. I'll probably be starting sometime in the fall, the actual writing of it. I've done the research, and right now I am trying to take this book. I've been asked to take this book and turn it into an e-book as well. For Learned Society, American Council of Learned Society.
What does that involve? You have to excerpt or?
Well, it's a new process to me, and so I'm just learning it now as I go along. But the Congress evidently funded some programs to facilitate this type of experimental work, and what it entails basically is, you take my book, and then let's say I'm discussing a speech gave in 1937. At that point in the text, there would be a link And if there's an audio file of the speech, you would then hear it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's great.
And, yeah. And then, you know, I've done oral history interviews, about 20 or so, for the book. So I only have short excerpts of it in this book. But if we got to one, in the book, if you get to one of the areas where I interviewed one of his sons or a political friend or foe, you know, you wanted to... Yes, well, you could, I guess you could do it in an audio file, but you could actually, I could insert a piece of transcript.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get a more in-depth.
So you just click on that and go deeper.
Well, then you would, you know, you could pull up a text file, and then you could see the context in which that information was arrived at.
Great, that's great.
So there are a lot of different websites would be inserted in the book. So, for example, you know, a lot of his enemies and his own family, they transported themselves to the United States, and so those old political struggles are still going on in Miami, even though the people are 80 and 90 years old.
Still arguing.
And so,
arguing about Batista?
Yeah, or, you know, Cuba today, but
yeah,
there's still
yeah.
a divided along pre-revolutionary party lines.
Oh, really?
And so you can go to a website and see what the party is saying. So, for example, when I'm writing about some of the political parties that oppose Batista, if you wanted to see a link of the party today, you know, now in exile, no longer in
Cuba. Great, really puts it in context, doesn't it?
So that's a new type of book.
That'd be great advance, I hope they get
it. That'd be. That's like a lot of work.
Like I say, I'm just experimenting with it now, so...
And I guess as you gather your research, it will help to have that in mind this time around, right? So
sure.
You're grabbing different things that you might not have...
To go to Godfather 2 on in your second...
There you go.
That's right.
Francis Ford to give you some rights.
like an action of my own.
Yeah. We didn't talk about your personal mission in doing this. We want to say hi to the kids too.
Sure. Well, yeah? Hello, Amanda and Andrew, if you're listening. I did call my daughter as I went out to get you a cup of coffee.
Thank you.
A call, and so she was a great, both my children were a great inspiration because I think. As a father, you always have to try to leave a legacy for your children, you know. In my own modest way, I want them to see, you know, you work hard and these are the results. My wife, of course, is very supportive in terms of this. And carry a friend. But it was a family project, really, because I left a good paying job. I was Congressman Menendez, now Senator Menendez's press secretary. And to embark on being a college fellow, a graduate fellow at Rutgers, and of course my salary dropped plummeted.
Dramatically.
And so I couldn't have done
it. And what a time to abandon ship!
Well, I'm glad I did. Press secretary, you're always. Expressing the views of someone else and never your own. But my daughter and son, you know, they were always watching me, you know, keyboard, you know, and I'd be working late at my office at Rutgers. And so, you know, we always try to eat together. And my daughter, inevitably, or my son, at the end of the day, I'd walk in the door and they'd greet me, "How many pages did you write today, Dad?" You know.
Very good. We need more of that.
And so I've always tried to involve them, and my daughter suggested some of the chapter titles.
Uh-huh.
I'd be debating, you know, which title to put on the chapter, and I'd ask her, and she would have a quick response. There's only an 8-year-old, you know, she was 8 at that time, but now 10. And,
Is your background Cuban American?
Yes.
Oh.
My father immigrated from Cuba, and... ironically, I wouldn't have been born probably without Batista.
Really?
Yes, but he's not my father.
Okay.
I don't want to
get
the hand.
There was a problem there with the taste test.
Oh, really?
But, yeah.
But, my
wandered.
Mom, yeah, yes, we did.
A womanizer.
But, my father was a railroad conductor, and the railroads were heavily unionized. And ironically, the priest was also a railroad conductor.
Yeah, a very serious accident. Mm-hmm.
But my father, although not a politically active person, was friends with a union leader on the railroads. And as often happened in the 50s during the Revolution, people mysteriously disappeared and then would be found dead. Mm-hmm. And so his friend was found dead. And so he became concerned about that he would be killed by association. Mm-hmm. And so he decided to take a leave of absence from the railway and then come here. So he came here in 1955.
The Revolution.
Yes, right. Right. As I say, he, you know, in a way, Batista has a hand in this and all the things that are going on in Cuba. And so then he came to really love the country, and he decided to stay. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, once the revolution occurred, 3.5 years later, he, you know, he felt he couldn't go back at that point. Mm-hmm. So,
But you have been. You have been to Cuba.
Yes, I've been there on several occasions, and actually there's a whole bunch of stories I could tell you about that. That's quite an adventure. It's quite an extraordinary journey in and of itself.
Were any of your oral... I'm sorry, I'm taking over.
No, I'm just checking.
Were any of your oral reviews conducted with Cubans in Cuba?
Well, I tried to do that, but the Cubans are very sensitive about this issue because... And I try to explain that a little bit in my preface. See, for a historian, one of my mentors in the field always said, as a historian, the deader the better.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're dealing with people who have a memory of events and are so emotionally linked to them, it really makes history very difficult.
The Daniel Wolfe syndrome. Is it the fellow who wrote 4th of July Asbury Park? And he didn't interview a lot of people who were still alive, yet wrote about them in his book. And my feeling was that Helen, who actually went out and people realized what she was doing. With Dan, I mean, most people didn't know about the book being in the works until it came out. One of the things was that Henry Caparo went up to him and said, you know, you're going to sign my book. And he said, sure, what's your name? He said, I don't know my name. You've got me on 5 pages.
But that is always the problem, though, because you impose yourself into the story, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, as a historian, you just try to stay out of it, but inevitably...
The very nature of taking the history.
Well, the danger in terms of... For the Cubans is that they have a vested interest in demonizing, and don't get me wrong, I want to be very clear about this, I'm not a fan of Batista. I'm not trying to rehabilitate him in this book.
Right.
That was a fear that you had.
No.
I was more concerned that, you know, you can have to spend 2 hours with somebody who adored Castro. That was my real fear. But anyway.
So the Cuban Revolution has a very invested interest in not redefining the piece. That he's fine just the way he is, as a puppet, a caricature.
A puppet of the U.S. who ran.
And so I had a devil of a time with them because, one, I had worked with Menendez, so they had a file on me to begin with.
How did they feel about Menendez?
Oh, well, they abhor him, and because he's one of the principal proponents of the Cuban embargo. But anyway, they knew that I had worked with him and so forth. And so... when I arrived in first of all, you want me to go into a little bit more about Cuba? Well, I went there. I went there for the first time in 1985. I'll just briefly tell you that. And at that time, I was a journalist, for our old paper, The Home News.
Mm-hmm.
And there I wasn't greeted particularly well either, and I, of course, had no, that time I was 25 and had, as far as I know, no record that, nonetheless, they wouldn't let me in there. They wouldn't let me in 1985.
Did you go for The Home News?
No, I went to visit some relatives that I have there. And so they stopped me there, and then they held me and another fellow, not I wouldn't say under arrest, but we basically were encircled by guards for several hours.
Okay.
And then, you know, I was thinking, you know, because I'm really, I think, a more Cuban-American than Cuban per se, because I'm born in the United States, and so I think a lot in North American terms. Mm-hmm. So like a typical U.S. person, I go up to the guard, and I say, I'd like to speak to your supervisor. You know, what's going on here? And so he says this in Spanish. You know, he lifts up his jacket and he points to his revolver. He says, this is the boss.
Oh,
well, I got the point, you know, and I said, okay, I got the idea. Very informative. Thank you very much. And then one more story from my short airport visit.
You could speak Spanish, then, which is a big help.
Yes,
huh?
Of course. Yes, yeah. I could speak Spanish. I knew. And he said it in Spanish. I'm just translating.
I still be trying to get the translation. I'd be dead by now. You'd still be arguing.
So then, you know, I left that brief discussion, more upset and saddened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was looking rather sad in a corner, and the cleaning lady comes around. We're in this airport, at that time not air conditioned, and we're by the air where the luggage comes down. So in comes this lady in mid-50s sweeping the floor, mm-hmm. and she comes up to me. She sees what's happened. She whispers to me, and she says, you're sad because they won't let you in. I'm sad because they won't let me out. So anyway, I was all in Havana all of 5 hours and all of these little stories. And there's one more, if you have time, from this little airport visit. They escort me and the other guy off the island onto the plane. And the planes in Cuba didn't land and come up by the terminal. Well, they wheel steps to them as you walk
right,
down.
Right, yeah.
No sleep.
Plus the tarmac.
So this guy, younger than I, really got mad, you know, at the way they treated us. So he gets this caca notion that the plane is U.S. territory, you know, and we're now safe on the plane. So he goes up to the stairs
Uh-oh.
And starts giving the guards the finger.
Oh, my God.
Rejected, yeah. So, you know, and starts cursing at them. I won't repeat what he was saying. So sure enough, we're the only two people on the plane, mind you, and a few moments later, he's running back to the seat, and I said, don't sit next to me.
Yeah.
And so the guards, of course, come on the plane, you know, and one of them has I don't know, I'm not an arms expert, but he has a machine gun. It looks like an automatic weapon slung across his chest. And he says to him very quietly, there's not many people in the plane, he says, we don't tolerate that here. And he's kind of waiting to see if this guy is going to say anything. And I'm hoping he doesn't, because I envision several nights in a Havana jail here.
Yes.
You know, so he doesn't. And the guard finally leaves. You know, we get thrown out and sent back to Miami.
That's what happened. You had to go back to Miami.
Yes. Yeah. So that's my last visit.
Very scary.
Story.
Yeah.
You must have wanted to know.
It was just a friend of yours. It's just somebody who...
No, I didn't know him.
Oh, my God. You're guilty by association.
Yeah, well, yes.
What was your complaint? That you didn't have the visa? Was it?
You know, they never explained why they didn't let me in. It was never clear.
So you didn't know when you went back again, whether they were going
to
let
you in? Well, actually, I tried to go back in 1998 for my research. And in Cuba, you have to have a scholar working with you, a senior scholar. And there was a person, an older man, who was writing a biography of the priest in Cuba, since died. And he was willing to sponsor me there. But again, I submitted my name and so forth, and once they made the connection to Menendez, he told me, listen, don't bother coming.
Oh, really?
So I'll tell you how I got in, finally.
Yeah, how did it? Did he reverse boat load or something?
Reverse boat load, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, in 1999, the Association of Caribbean Historians, which I'm a member, had its convention there. And once the Cuban government allowed the convention to be held there, they had to let in the members. So I got in that way. But I did have one more little story for you about my tortured travel to Cuba. I stayed with my wife's cousin, and so I don't know that they had a clear idea of where I was, you know, in my first day or two. I arrived before the conference. And then, but when I arrived, the old Havana Hilton, now called the Havana Libre, in a beautiful old hotel, Art Deco, 19...
The buildings are wonderful. Yeah, you know. Michael Calafati had a very, very nice show on it. He went down with the architect. And I was just looking at him and all that.
Well, the architecture of the Havana Libre is that on the second floor you have sort of a promenade looking down on the lobby. And so, you know how you have that tingling sense that something is not right? I'm sure you've all had that in your lives,
yeah.
You know? So I knew when I walked in the hotel, I don't know why, I knew that something wasn't right. And then on the second floor, I look up, and there's a guy, you know, looking like a man in black, you know, from the movie.
Yeah,
and here
yeah.
it is, and it's Havana, mid-April, and he's wearing a suit and tie and sunglasses. And stuff. I said, this guy, something wrong here. So he's looking through a folder, and I could sense he saw some recognition when he saw me.
Uh-huh.
And then within a minute or two of that, I was approached by a functionary, as Card said. And so...
Was the same guy or somebody working for him?
No, somebody else.
Oh, uh-huh.
Someone from the foreign ministry, the Cuban foreign ministry. So he says to me, well, welcome to Havana, Dr. Freyer. But why have you come? You're an enemy of the revolution. So this is not a good... This
enemy
is not a good start.
Yeah.
So he says, well, no, you know, I'm here to do research. I'm not a man of, violence. I'm here to do scholarly work.
Right.
And I'm here at the conference, and you all approved this conference, and here I am. He says, well, Dr. Freyer, can we talk a bit? You know, and this is not one of those... You know, can we talk? This is one we will talk, or you're out on the next plane to Canada or wherever.
Yeah.
So anyway, we had a little chat, and he asked me a lot of questions about Mendez and all sorts of things. But anyway, I bought him breakfast, and I would end up having to buy him breakfast for the next week, you know. And so I sort of befriended him.
Those dollars go over very well, don't they?
So. But there's sort of an epilogue to that little tale. So they let me stay in Cuba, and I was able to spend 3 weeks there and travel to Batista's hometown.
Oh, so you
got
in.
Yeah, I was able to
stay.
But I gave a little presentation. So I went, I was asked to give a presentation, following presentation at CUNY in New York City about 2 or 3 years ago now. And I was nearing the completion of this book. At that point, and the dissertation part of it, and then, you know, I was getting very close to finishing. So they asked me to give a talk on my work. And so there are about 80 people there, and I walk in. Who's the first person I see but him?
Oh, my God.
Yes, I go over to him. I say, how are you? I'll tell you his name. But hey, how are you? How are you doing? He says, you remember me, Dr. Freyer? Of course I remember you. You're the functionary, I said.
Functionary? So what happened? How did he...
Well, I said to him, now listen, I was kidding around with him, and he got very serious, you know. I said to him, I just want you to know I'm going to say some things at this talk you might not like. So you got to let me back into Cuba, I said to him. He said, he feigned some sort of insult. Lord Freire, of course. Didn't we let you in before?
Yeah.
So I'll report back to you. I'll be going, trying to go in the next year and a half. So I'll let you know whether I get in.
So this is the first time you're going to be testing this this relationship. There's a real fear factor that you've certainly experienced given the stories you've just told. You
really are trying to mind control, right?
Well, I mean, you definitely get a sense of a country that is very, very different. And there's some good things about that, and there's some negative things about that. But, I mean, it becomes clear that you cannot say what you wish in Cuba. That's for sure. And
you can't even say what you want. Well, I guess you can write it then.
No. I mean, we've had books, scholars have sent books in Cuba, and they're quickly confiscated. So I'm not sure whether my book would be allowed in or not.
Because you did take a journalist and, you know, an objective view on Batista.
Right. I don't try to sugarcoat anything. And we have a little bit, I can tell you a little bit about the relationship with the family in terms of getting some of the documents from them.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
Gross. Yes, okay. Just giving me the 7-minute warning here.
Okay, yeah, just let me know when we have to stop. But when I first met the Batista family, they knew I didn't know very much about Substore. I mean, I was just a novice. And so they weren't really giving me information that was of great value. They're very politically astute. You know, the family is having...
His descendants.
His children. Mm. His oldest son is particularly an extremely smart person, physically astute, and had been elected to the Cuban Congress in the last election, if you want to call it that, under the Batista government. So, but as I did more and more research, I mean, I started to find things about the corruption in Cuba, about the brutality. And so there are a couple of things in there you'll see that are right from the archives talking about...
These are in Cuba, archives in Cuba?
No, mostly from the United States, some in Cuba. But, for example, a lot of his political opponents, what they would do, Batista had muscle men in the government who, you know, if you got out of line, you'd be visited. I mean, whether you were a senator or a congressman, you'd be visited by them, you know. And this is... If you get a chance, you'll look through the book. You'll see there's a look under Belisario Hernandez, under that name, and you'll see some of the scoring. But in any case, and the congressmen and senators had a way of dealing with this, too. What they would do is, let's say, you know, one of the strongmen came to my house. I would try to stall him and, you know, get my wife to call some other senator to congressmen. And so... They had a fraternity like this. So even opposing congressmen and senators would all of a sudden converge on the House, and that sort of public shame factor would dissuade them from taking it.
Oh.
You know, so I don't skirt that issue.
But they would take someone away.
No, not in that case. But certainly cases of brutality under the Batista regime are not a rarity.
Yeah.
And I only point that out to...
Were people disappeared under the Batista regime?
Yes. People, particularly, now, this book only goes up to the 40s. His more brutal regime is in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And
volume 2.
Right. It's not unusual. It's not unusual for... you know, people to be murdered and then their bodies left in a public park. Okay? And then the Batista family and Batista himself will tell you that he had no direct involvement in those things. Okay? Which, you know, is probably so, but in terms of a direct involvement, but he certainly, obviously, had no control of those who were doing it either. You know, so the question, it's an ambivalent question.
Well,
wouldn't
he have
had
control over them, though? I mean, why would he feel free to do something that he wouldn't want within?
Well, I think that what often happens with power is that these things are not expressed in such a black and white way. Like, for example, if he might have spoken badly of someone, that right away might trigger other people to say, okay, well, maybe this is an enemy of the regime.
Sort of what happened with Thomas Becker. Who originally of the priest, publishing priest. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when he was murdered, he said, I had nothing to do with it.
Right. I only asked a question.
Yeah. But the thing that's critical about it is, and this you can say about the priest, is but he rarely did an investigation that went anywhere. Into the best. That you can say. There's a case here.
Lack of follow through. That would be a flaring.
Like there's a case here, really horrible case in one of the battles of the Revolution of 33. A group of government rebels surrendered. Okay, by this time Batista is in the government. And one of them, a guy named Juan Blas Hernandez, had been a well-known revolutionary figure in Cuba in the 30s. All right? So this guy surrendered. One of Batista's lieutenants calls out to find him. He raises his hand and then proceeds to shoot him in the head.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So now, Batista obviously didn't call for that shooting per se, but nothing ever happened to the person who shot him.
There's a little bit of that in Washington right now, actually.
That's
not something.
So my point in telling you that story is not to try to sugarcoat his record, but only trying to give you the complexity and nuance. Because there are a lot of good things he does, too, in terms of his reform program.
We have 2.5 minutes. I just want to ask you, what was your feeling about Batista's relatives, whether they were really being objective with you or whether they were carrying the party line? And did they have any incentive, do you think, to just be really honest?
Well, I think they're in a difficult position. But I think the reason that they, the photos that are in the book, the 19 photos, are from the Batista family. And
they are great photos. People should really go and check them.
Yes, you have to get this
wonderful.
You have to go to Borders, or you can go right on my site. If you're out of town, go on the coming up on page, and you can click on there.
It's also
and
on Amazon.
That's my little Amazon link.
Nice.
That is my Amazon link.
Oh,
okay. My
kids in the college
fun
thing.
Yes.
But the family, they're in a difficult position because they love him, and of course they want to protect his legacy. And I think the reason they cooperated with me was that nothing I would write could possibly demonize him further. But having said that, they objected to many parts of the book.
Would you have to let them see it? Or?
No, I didn't have to let them see it, but as a historian, what I would do is the following. When I got information that was damaging about my father, I would send it to them, and this would force them to actually release documents to follow.
Okay.
So it was a cat and mouse game.
Very wise.
And that's how it worked. I'd send them a document and say, well, listen, how about this? You said he was in no brutality, no corruption. Well, how about this document? Yeah. And then they would release documents and say, well, look at this, and then they would counter it. Okay.
Very, very shrewd.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Hopefully he doesn't hear this, because I'm counting on this.
I've got to thank our Linda.
No, he's well aware of
that. Enjoying this discussion so much. I hate to be the one to pull the plug on it. And I know somebody's calling. What happens when people are really engrossed, they don't want to call in and interrupt the flow of what you're saying. So sometimes they wait until the very end of the show. And it's
too late
right now. Very quickly. You're on the line. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, Daddy.
Oh.
There's my co-author, Amanda. How are you, sweetheart?
Hi.
Hi,
how you doing?
Amanda.
Did you hear the interview?
Yes.
Okay. Did
how
you
did
like
your dad do?
Good.
All right.
Rousing applause.
That's
thank you.
That's a tough audience, too.
Yeah.
Did you hear how I mentioned your contribution?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Well, Dad loves you.
Bye, Ed.
Okay.
Bye. Thank you, Amanda.
Bye.
All right. And how old is your son?
My son is 7. Andrew.
Andrew. All right. Well, we'll give a shout out to Andrew too and Carrie. keeping the mob and so there. We want to thank the people who bring this type of wonderful discussion to the airwaves every week. And that's Galsworthy Arms and that Citadel Equity Group of New Jersey. And give Joanne a call if you want more information about Galsworthy Arms. 908-337-2224. And go on Asbury Radio. And you will see in California. We want to thank the hardware store. 6 years they've been supporting this show. We're going to have our formal anniversary show on the 22nd. Frank Alessandro will be here. I understand Rhoda Margano and Rodney, Sophie Fields will be here. The whole cast, of characters. That's the hardware store at 48 Main Street in Asbury Park, the Summerlin Coons LLP, 601 Bangs Avenue, 861-1500. And the Metro Lyric Opera, don't forget them, of New Jersey. Make out a check and send it to Post Office Box 35, Allen Hurst, 07711. And the firm of Bone Furniture LLC and Red Bank Special Fund Condemnation and Land Domain and Redevelopment Law. Call Furniture is 345-0600. All right. Thank you so much, Frank. A goody prayer. I did it. And Laura Martello, excellent question.
And we should speak
so
up.
We have to speak up.
Why?
You can speak up.
That's my
cue.
Please, WYGG, would you come